So that street.
That's what happens when you read bills, Arnie.
That's right, you should quit doing that.
Yeah, we gotta quit reading bills.
For a couple more minutes.
Well, we're.
We're gonna open the Senate Education Committee here on May 2nd, 2017, 2 days away from a very important day. That would be the 4th of May, which many people understand for me is an important day. With that being.
And how many of those important days will you have had?
I don't know. Let's see, how many would have had? I've had a, well, because the movie hadn't started till I was a certain age. I don't know how many actually. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2399. And we're going to have a staff measure summary. And Representative Fahey, you're welcome to come up and bring anybody you would like to have with you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2399 establishes the Condon Collection at the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History as the official repository for paleontological material that may come into the possession of the state of Oregon. The bill assigns responsibility for material custody and safekeeping to the MNCH. It prohibits interference with existing collections in the possession of any post-secondary institution in Oregon and allows individuals and private entities to gift paleontological collections directly to any institution.
And I probably shouldn't say this, but Senator Gelser would love to talk to you about this bill at some point. And I'll let her describe that later.
All right.
That's just for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senator Gelser and I have plenty of opportunity to chat.
That would be the opportune time to have that chat.
My name is Julie Fahey, and I'm the state representative from House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. House Bill 2399 would establish the Condon Collection at the University of Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History as Oregon State Museum of Paleontology. UO's Museum of Natural and Cultural History is our state's primary repository for publicly owned collections. In 1935, it was established by the legislature as the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology. And since I minored in anthropology, I'm particularly qualified to talk about this bill. The museum is accredited by the American Alliance of Museums, distinguishing it as one of the very best in the nation. This museum and all of its collections enhance our knowledge of Earth's environment and cultures, inspiring stewardship of Oregon's collective past, present, and future. The Condon Collection is named after Thomas Condon, who was one of the first three professors at the university. He brought to the university an extensive collection of fossils, which was later named in his honor. By making this designation, we hope to make Oregon more competitive in attracting special items and collections of scientific interest, and to aid in fundraising for the museum's endowment. 24 other states have designated such paleontology museums. And with that, I'd now like to introduce Dr. Greg Vitalik, who is the director of the Condon Collection at the UO, and Edward Davis, who is its curator. They're going to provide the committee with some more details and background, and they can answer any questions about the museum that you might have. Thank you very much. And I may be getting back to the floor session because
we are
currently in session. So,
any questions for our representative? Have a fun time on the floor.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm Edward Davis. I'm the curator of the fossil collection, the Condon Fossil Collection at the UO Museum. And I think one of the things that's really important to me to note about the collection and its role in the state is that it dates back to Thomas Condon's activities as one of the first state geologists and also the first professor of science at the University of Oregon. So the collections that we have are important for science research, important for the history of the state in a natural history context, but they're also important for the state in a history of the state, a human history context as well. One of the things that we're looking forward to with the passage of the bill is protecting the state property of fossils. So there's a lot of fossils that are still in the ground in state lands, and we're trying to find a way to make sure that those fossils remain in the state and become part of the resources available for researchers and members of the public. And in that way, we would actually meet up with 24 other states that have established state museums as well. One of the things that's also important is that there are a lot of people who've made collections of fossils from Oregon state lands or from private lands in Oregon over their lifetimes, either as researchers or as people who are just enthusiasts. And by becoming the designated state repository, we can help those collections come into the possession of the state and maintain the presence in Oregon. So that's one of the things that we've seen a lot of. I guess my third point here is that we've seen several important collections leave the state of Oregon because of people not recognizing the Museum at the University of Oregon as an important state repository. So collections of really important scientific and cultural significance have ended up at the Smithsonian Institution, which is not a bad place for them to be, but we would be happier if we could keep those in Oregon so that they would be more available to the people of Oregon for educational purposes. So I think those are the main points I wanted to make with my testimony today. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Chair Roblin, senators. I'm Greg Retallick. I'm the director of the museum, and this is a part of an overall effort that we've been involved in for the last 5 years to boost the profile of the museum. We now have 50 employees, believe it or not, and a budget of almost $500,000. And we're really on a mission to make this thing sit with the university. We're building an endowment. So I go to a lot of cocktail parties. I meet a lot of the former rockhounds who have alienated their wives but still want to give us their fossil collections. So we're really trying to build something in Eugene that the state will be proud of, and we think that this resolution will really help us in that endeavor. We have quite an effort also in education. Our education division of the museum actually visited all but three counties in Oregon to give presentations on natural history subjects as an enrichment for primary through secondary schools. We have initiated a set of lectures. We're finding that these are really quite successful in building a museum community. If you're in Eugene and you're looking for something interesting to do, we have new displays, both of anthropology and geology, and we have a killer banquet every year with something like 300 people, which is on a natural history theme, the talk, and the usual wine and banquet. It's become one of our signature events. So all of this is part of our ambition to make our collection one of the premier natural history collections on the West Coast. Thanks for your attention.
Questions? I have a couple. Have we worked with our 9 better recognized tribes as things come in, and it turns out that maybe some of the things you get aren't really as old as they are, but they are Native American in origin, to get them back to the tribes or to work out some arrangements? Do we have arrangements with the tribes?
Yes, that's a that's an important question. And so one of the things that we do as collections come in is we the first step is just to decide whether those collections are appropriately paleontological or whether they ought to be with the anthropology side of the museum, the established Oregon State Museum of Anthropology. And if it becomes clear that the collections come from a time period after humans are present in Oregon, then those collections are automatically moved over to the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology. And then they have in place all of the NAGPRA system for dealing with the tribes and making sure that the remains are properly dealt with. So since I've been at the University of Oregon, and I began in 2007, so this is my 10th year, we've only had one case where something came into the fossil collection and it became clear that it ought to be in the anthropology collection, and so it was moved over very quickly and taken care of by the experts there. So we have a good relationship with the archaeologists, and so I think that that's an important part of our overall museum workflow already established. Thank you.
And my other question is that now that we believe, or at least some people in California believe, that man has been here for 100,000 years or more because they found the one bone that was crushed by the rocks that were nearby.
Right.
Have you guys made any opinion as to whether or not that to be an appropriate new find, or do we just not have enough information yet?
I'll speak for our director, who is yeah. John Erlinson, and he's skeptical. I'm a little skeptical, too. We had the record until then, as you may know.
Yeah, I know.
And so
I did.
We're a little worried about this. So I think you can expect skepticism until there's further proof from California that what they have is what they really have. They don't have any bones. They don't have any DNA. They have some rather suspicious-looking bones that are broken up lengthways as if the marrow was being extracted. But that's, I've seen these sorts of bones even in the Oligocene and Miocene rocks of Central Oregon way before humans. So you can expect skepticism from us. And we're still in the business, of course, of documenting some of the oldest humans in the U.S., particularly at Paisley Caves and some of our other places.
That was, from my perspective, that find in those caves was pretty remarkable.
Well, we have the coprolites with DNA, so we really have it down.
To be clear, by we, he means the museum overall.
Well, yes.
The fossil collection does not have the coprolites because they fall under the domain of the Anthropology Museum. We collaborate closely with those folks, and I actually have a paper that I recently published with Dr. Dennis Jenkins looking at the horses from Paisley Cave. So we're working with them to try to understand the overall ecological history that's recorded in those sequences. So we see in the Paisley Cave sequences, times that have humans and times where the humans weren't present, and so, but the animals are continuous, and so by looking at that, we're actually starting to understand the impact that even the first Americans had on ecosystems, which is exciting. So,
and I'll final with this one, which makes me believe that if they were there then, they had to have come from somewhere before that. So we should be looking, if we believe they walked here,
right.
We should be looking north to find out if there's evidence and how long it took them to get down here, because they usually didn't walk in a straight line to get to Paisley.
No, it's true.
Well, they walked to Paisley.
A bit north of us.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
They may have walked to Paisley, but the house view from John, of course, is the kelp highway hypothesis.
Awesome. Yeah.
They actually paddled.
Yeah.
And so from that point of view,
that's true.
San
they
Diego's
could be the
nice
oldest.
And coastal, so that's a possibility. But we would think that they would have left more evidence than just those crummy bones in San Diego.
That's true. Any other questions? Sorry, they got into an issue that I care about.
Mr. Chair, I think a good longtime friend of mine, Cheryl Ford, might be interested
in
the passage. I think she's got some connection with museums at the U of O.
I don't know enough.
And so thank you both for being here, and thanks for having a really amazing collection and university, and actually the history of it with Condon, too, is really important. So the history of the history is equally important for our state. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No one else, right? So with that, there is no one else to come. So thank you, and we're going to close our public hearing on 2399. I think we'll move this as soon as we can. Any concerns or anything?
Work sessions?
Not today. We don't have one. But
Okay. Yeah.
So with that, we're going to move on to our work sessions. And
where did you want to do?
Yeah, we can wait and see.
Okay.
It appears we aren't going to wait. As soon as we get through the work sessions, we'll go on to the other bills. There are people here that can help with that. So if he makes it, great. If he doesn't, we're okay, too. So with that, we'll go through our work sessions fairly quickly. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2147. We'll have a short explanation to remember the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of committee, the A2 amendment replaces the measure. It requires the higher education institutions to provide the following information to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission annually: the number of Oregon high school graduates from each school district enrolled at the institution, and the graduation rate at that institution for Oregon high school graduates from each school district. It requires HEC to submit that information to the Oregon Department of Education, and requires ODE to provide that information to school districts. The bill excludes career schools.
Okay, so this is one of those that I think would be helpful for high school to understand where their kids went to school and which ones graduated. So I hope that everything can work out. Is there? So, Senator Lithgow.
Chair Roblin, let's see. I will make, since the Dash 2's got to come first, I'll move the Dash 2 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, it's not a simple 2, it's a Dash A2 amendment dated 4/7 of 2017.
Yeah, we're now in those House bills.
Yeah, right.
They have A's and B's on them. Senator Lithgow moves the A2 amendments dated 4/7/17. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Lithcomb.
Chair Roblin, I will now move HB 2147 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithcomb moves House Bill 2147 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any conversation or discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Who would like to carry this bill, if anyone? If I see no hands rushing forward, I will take this one, recognize that there will be other people carrying other ones in the future. And I'm hopeful that the one that we pushed off till later, we had the hearing on today, that Senator Gelser would love to take. So we'll see about that as we get closer. So with that, we're going to go to House. We're going to close the work session on 2147. We're going to open a work session on 2457. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 20.
Oh, wait, we should first have an explanation real quick. Sorry about that.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2457 modifies the Higher Education Coordinating Commission process to review and appropriately act on student complaints regarding schools operating in Oregon. It restricts HEC to investigating and resolving student complaints that relate to state financial aid. The bill allows HEC to refer a student complaint to the appropriate state agency if the complaint alleges that a school has violated a state law concerning consumer protection, civil rights, employment rights, or environmental quality. Allows HEC to refer student complaints to the school's accrediting association if the complaint relates to the school's authorization to offer academic degree programs or to the quality of the school's academic degree programs. The bill allows HEC to refer student complaints to the school at which the student is enrolled if HEC determines that the complaint should be resolved through the school's internal review process. The bill defines school as an independent, not-for-profit institution of higher education and clarifies that schools do not include schools that offer degrees in theology or religious occupations.
So as we remember this bill, we had some of the schools that are the not-for-profits, like the Willamette, say, we need to have a process for our people because we want to make sure that they have a clear process. This allows HEC to help intercede in that and send it where it wants to, but not keep any records of it, and I think that's an appropriate way to deal with it. So with that, Senator Lithcomb.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithcomb moves House Bill 2457 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any conversation or is there any opposition? So moved. Anyone wish to carry this bill? Oh, no one's done. Okay. Well,
I'm a Willamette.
He's one of those Willamette kids. That's right. So we'll have Senator Cruz. We'll close our work session on House Bill 2457. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2565. We'll hear a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2565 modifies the priority enrollment system to offer course registration to continuing qualified students prior to continuing non-qualified students within the same credit year classification. The bill requires public universities and community colleges to accommodate priority registration for new qualified students as practical pursuant to institutional orientation requirements.
So this one, if we remember, had to do mostly with veterans and their ability to get priority records registration. And in a large part to make sure that they can meet the requirements of their GI Bill kinds of things in a timely manner. So with that, Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2565 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2565 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Senator Lithcomb, you want to carry this one?
Sure, I'll carry it.
With that, we'll close our House Bill, close the work session on House Bill 2565. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2314. So we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2314 allows the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to set minimum standards by rule for graduation from hair design, barbering, aesthetics, or nail technology schools.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
Let's see. Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2314 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Lithicum moves House Bill 2314 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition?
In terms of discussion, the
yes.
We've had a lot of conversation about those various trade schools and proficiency-based requirements, standards being set within those various institutions and academic settings, training schools, et cetera, versus having HEC establish those hourly rates by rule. And I actually think it's another bite too large for HEC. HEC's already got their plate full, and that these private institutions could manage their own curriculum requirements and training needs would be more appropriate than trying to put something in HEC's lap that HEC already is you know, stretched to their limits of their resources. So I've got a problem with putting this in HEC's lap, and I will vote no or recommend we continue to allow HEC to bless the rules established by those trade schools and committees.
Want me to put this over? Because one of our people is not here, so I'm going to move this bill without taking action. What can I do? How do I do that?
Sure, I'll withdraw the motion.
Okay. Senator Withicklin withdraws the motion, and we will carry over House Bill 2314 to the next meeting. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2314. Thank you for that, and we'll look into that as well. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2220. We'll have a short explanation and have a gentleman who could never replace Senator Wisnett, but Representative Wisnett, thank you. So, short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2220 modifies school district criteria for issuing high school diplomas to veterans by removing the requirement that veterans do not graduate from high school due to service to the armed forces, and requirement that veterans must have received GED certificate, general education development certificate, post-secondary degree, or minimum score on the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery.
Okay. All right, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, and honorable members of this committee. For the record, my name is Hugh Ady, and I serve as the budget and policy analyst in the House Republican office. I am here today at the request of Representative Gene Wisnant to testify on House Bill 2220. This legislation presents an opportunity to this committee to express its appreciation to our veterans that have sacrificed so much for their country. Currently, Oregon statute requires veterans to meet certain requirements in order to apply for and receive a high school diploma from the school district where they are living or from the district where they attended high school prior to serving. These requirements largely affect older veterans, as the vast majority of today's soldiers have high school diplomas when they enter the armed forces. Older veterans that have a GED but lack a high school diploma may be prevented from getting a job with a business that requires a high school diploma to be considered for employment. As a result, veterans in Oregon that have essentially earned their diplomas, save for technicalities, cannot obtain a diploma after their service has ended. This is especially frustrating since what may be preventing a veteran from obtaining their post-secondary degree is the fact that they lack a high school diploma, which is needed to get their high school diploma in the first place. This legislation amends statute to essentially guarantee that any veteran who attended high school before serving in the armed forces and was honorably discharged or released will be able to apply for a high school diploma from the school district that they currently reside in or where they attended high school before serving. Considering the significant sacrifices that our men and women in uniform have made, it is incumbent upon us to do all that we can to help them succeed after they have returned home. House Bill 2220 passed out of the House Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee on a unanimous vote. It also passed the House floor on a unanimous vote. Representative Wisnant respectfully requests that your support for House Bill 2220. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
So, any questions?
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I will say that as a high school principal, there were a few years ago, there was a big movement to help World War II veterans, mm-hmm. as they were getting older, to get their high school diplomas. And we had the opportunity to issue a few of those honorary diplomas to some veterans. And I believe it was a really great experience for all of the students graduating that year. For those gentlemen, actually went to a couple houses because they were in situations where they couldn't get to the high school to give them their diplomas. And it meant an awful lot. to those people. And I had a father-in-law who enlisted in the Second World War at 16, and his commanding officer called back to his high school after the war to ask him if they'd give him a diploma, and they said no. And the commanding officer said, it's good we're not in the same room. Because the kinds of things that they're going to go through and the training they're going to get is probably going to match up with the kinds of requirements you would want to finish out their diploma. And we tried everything at our school when a veteran would come by to say, what have you done? Where have you been? Can we make an adjustment between that and the requirements you had left? And we're able to, in most cases, figure that out. So I think this is a really good bill. I don't think people know how much and how important it is sometimes for these people who made a decision to go in to serve the country and do things, and then to not have respectfully dealt with when they come back would be really bad. So I appreciate the bill coming here personally. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So there's no one else on the list to talk to, so thank you for that. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2220. I anticipate we will have this up for a work session as soon as possible. With that, we're going to open work session on House Bill 2229, and we'll hear a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2229 modifies the common curriculum goals, performance indicators, and diploma requirements set by the State Board of Education to include financial literacy. It requires school districts and public charter schools to include financial literacy instruction with current core subjects of mathematics, science, English, history, geography, economics, civics, physical education, health, the arts, and world languages. The bill requires that school districts and public charter schools offer students sufficient courses in financial literacy to ensure those electing to receive instruction do receive it. The bill takes effect July 1st, 2018.
Thank you.
And again, for the record, Chair Roblin, Vice Chairs, and honorable members of this committee, my name is Hugh Ady, and I serve as the Budget and Policy Analyst in the House Republican Office. I am here today at the request of Representative Wisnett to testify on House Bill 2229. Last year, the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College conducted a study of financial literacy in all 50 states. The state of Oregon received a B- as a result of that study. The study specifically evaluated adults' financial knowledge, credit, savings, retirement readiness, investments, and insurance levels. In total, Oregonians were evaluated on 71 financial literacy metrics. And on nearly half of those factors, they received either a C, a D, or an F. The Oregonian article that highlighted the results of this study plainly stated, Oregonians aren't very financially savvy, which can lead to uninformed and poor choices about their money. The amended version of this bill would encourage school districts and public charter schools to offer students courses or other educational opportunities in financial literacy, and allow every student that wants to receive instruction in financial literacy to be able to do so. Financial literacy, that can include topics such as budgeting, checkbook management, credit management, savings. This bill is a step in the right direction to ensuring future generations of Oregonians will have these vital financial skills. I personally can speak to the merits of this bill. I'm a proud graduate of South Salem High School. I don't think I ever took advantage of a financial literacy course while I was there. It would have benefited me during my college years when I made some poor spending choices that largely involved fast food, and I'm paying the price for that now. This legislation has the support of financial institutions and associations such as the Oregon State Credit Union, Northwest Credit Union Association, and the Oregon Bankers Association, and it also passed out of the House unanimously. And out of the House floor unanimously. Representative Wisnett urges your aye vote and respectfully requests your support for House Bill 2229. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? So this is not a mandate. It's basically a opportunity.
Opportunity. Chair Roblin, the amended version of this bill, initially the base bill had a requirement in there. The dash one amended the bill to encourage school districts to take advantage of offering financial literacy. So,
okay. Any other questions? Cool. Thank you very much. And we do have a person who's been waiting all afternoon to be able to come up here and speak about something she cares about dearly, Pam Levitt. Can we don't get you in here very often. It's so nice
I
to
know.
Have you visiting us.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. This is my second time, actually, testifying in here, so it's very exciting. In my 23 years representing Oregon credit unions, this has been a passion of mine. I strongly believe in financial education, financial literacy, especially for our youth. And now that I have two teenage kids, I especially care about the issue. They both have debit cards and are learning strongly about how when you swipe, you know, the numbers go down. It's been great. So I certainly reinforce that. I apologize, but I submitted 5 pages of testimony because I care so much about this issue. I included an article, and I included some examples of works that credit unions are doing all around the state. We care deeply about this issue, and while I know the bill says encourage and is not certainly a mandate, we certainly support every effort to teach financial literacy. 2 things I want to highlight are our high school branches, and I would love to bring all of you to one of our credit union high school branches. The credit unions invest in what is actually a branch of the credit union, and the kids run it as a class, as a finance class. They are the CEO. They are the tellers. They are the management staff. They learn not only financial education, but certainly business education. And so that's exciting. The other thing that we're doing around the state right now is what's called financial reality fairs. And the credit union will adopt a high school, and they'll go in with the staff. A certain class or a certain age group will get a packet, and you will be assigned a job. You will say, you are a gas station attendant. Here's how much you make a month. Go around and pay your utilities. Go over to the table that says utilities. Go pay your mortgage. Go pay for your groceries. They figure out how the number goes down, and paying for phone bills and those big screen TVs gets harder and harder. So the one-day financial reality fairs are happening in communities all around the state, so that's exciting. There are a number of things I could talk about, but I just want to finally say a society of financial literate consumers who can avoid scams, predatory lenders, and the enticement of overspending will never emerge without financial education in schools. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
And if they work hard enough, they will understand that credit unions are different from banks.
Thank you, sir.
I won't say better, yes. Whatever. And along that line, it was so frustrating to me when I was a principal those 25 years ago when we had our own bank, and it was a bank in our school because we couldn't get a credit union to help us. But I will tell you that having those facilities, it's not only the class that really does learn a lot more than they ever anticipated they were going to learn about how to manage and take care of this and stuff. It was really the parents and the kids that took advantage of it, because all of a sudden they really did have to manage, and they could deposit and take money out, do all those kind of things right at the high school, which was really a good experience for all of them.
Chair Roblin, I had to fight with my son, who will be a senior next year, on his electives to take personal finance. We went back and forth, and I mean, he should know that this is an important issue, and I had to go back and forth with him to get him to take that as an elective. So it really is a challenge to have students really want to engage in this issue. So that's why we see these other ways, the branches and the reality fairs, as ways to teach without forcing a class.
I remember when that wasn't an elective.
It was. It's true. It was a requirement.
Yeah. Absolutely. For me, too.
And I'll tell you, the other experience that I remember the most, because it was so fun to watch kids come to a realization that they'd made a mistake, we had a personal finance class, ran a little store in the class where you could buy candy bars and stuff, and in order to get it going, they all had to buy stock. So they all put in $1 or $2, and then they got this material, and they sold it and made a profit, and then they profit shared. But you could sell your stock. And there were some very insightful people at the beginning of the process who bought everybody's stock up. You know, they say, you paid $1 for that, but I'll give you $1.25. Okay, here's $1.25. And then they had a payout at the end of the semester. And they said, well, we had this much money come in, so each share is now worth $3.50. And the guy says, $3.50. I sold that for $1.25. He said, yeah, I know.
Welcome to the world of finance.
He said, Well, that's not fair. That's what it is. So, I mean, it was when kids get an opportunity to have real experiences and find out fairly short term good, bad decisions, it really is helpful for later on.
And there are wonderful things happening in the state. Financial Beginnings is a wonderful organization doing amazing things. You know, certainly the bankers do a great deal of work around the state in this issue and other entities. So I think we're all doing our part, but is it reaching all of our kids is certainly a question we've always asked. But we're certainly willing to support any efforts to go down the road of pushing this issue. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Yep. Any questions? Thank you very much. So with that, we will close our work session, our public hearing on House Bill 2229. And committee, I guess we'll put this one out, too, if anybody have any concerns about this bill. So seeing none, we'll put it up for a work session in the near future. That concludes our work for today, unless there's anybody out there that really wanted to come and testify. They haven't done it all session, and they were excited to come up and testify, not seeing anybody that wants to do that. So with that, we will close our Senate Education Committee for today, May 2nd. And may the 4th be with you shortly. May 2nd. And may the 4th be